Thank you, Brother Muhammad, and thank you, dear audience of IRIB English Radio. That was the final part of the program, Let's Recite the Quran. If you have any comments, questions, or suggestions, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. And don't forget to visit our website, that is parstoday.com. Please click on the tab Call of Islam, and there you can listen to this program as well as other programs of this radio. Until next time, we'll leave you in Allah's care. Have a nice time and goodbye. ذكر وموعظة ونور فيه شفاء للصدور وشفيعنا يوم النشور آياته تروي المدى وصفاته نبع الهدى نلقى الجنان بحبه لن تستقيم حياتنا إلا به هو القرآن والفرقان إليه تنصت الأكوان وفيه تعطر الآذان والقرآن ضياء يملأ الآفاق ونور يبعث الأشواق فيه محاسن الأخلاق هو القرآن
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Iran Radio presents some interesting facts about Islam. There are an estimated 1.8 billion Muslims in the world, which is about 1.5 of the world's population. Due to the birth and conversion rates, Islam is considered to be the fastest growing religion in the world today. Peace and greetings from Tehran. You're listening to Iran Radio. And today's programming is more than just a schedule. Of course, it's an invitation to reflect, to learn, and to feel connected. Let's begin. First, it's a new segment of radio productions. Then we tuned into A to Z of Life. Next, it's time for Israel Watch to round out the hour. Keep it locked in. We've got more for you.
There are activists who do not just challenge systems, they confront them head on. They blur the lines between protest and provocation, pushing public discourse into uncomfortable but necessary territory. Their work is often polarizing, but it's rooted in a deep conviction to dismantle injustice. My guest today is one such activist. Welcome to SORP. I am Bahman Roy.
Calla Walsh is an American political activist, writer and organizer known for her outspoken views on U.S. foreign policy, anti-imperialism and Palestinian solidarity. She is a member of the Democratic Socialists of America and co-chair of the National Network on Cuba. Walsh has contributed to different media outlets and has participated in delegations to Cuba and Syria. In 2023, she was arrested during direct actions targeting Elbit Systems, an Israeli military contractor, as part of a work with Palestine Action US.
Calla Walsh, it's a pleasure to have you on SORP.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. I know you must be very tired, but let me just get to the first question. We'll take it from there. What first sparked your interest in activism and political organizing?
I think the first issue that really sparked my interest was the climate crisis, and I quickly realized that we cannot stop the climate crisis without stopping imperialism, and that imperialism is the greatest destroyer of the environment in the world. And I think at first, as a kid in the United States, we aren't taught to care about any country except ourselves. But as my process of getting involved politically developed, I realized the necessity of fighting against U.S.-led imperialism.
Right. And were there formative experiences growing up that shaped your worldview?
Well, I was 12 years old when Donald Trump was elected, and certainly I don't think Donald Trump is an aberration in the long, long history of fascist, genocidal, racist U.S. presidents. But there was a huge spark of political activity and protest and momentum in that moment. And I got involved at a very young age in different movements, whether it was the Women's March, the March for Our Lives against gun violence, and later the 2020 protests against police violence and racism and brutality. And I was involved in many different ways of protesting, of organizing. And as I know we're going to talk about, one of those very formative experiences was working on campaigns and really trying to work within the system like we are told to, and trying to use all these legal means to make change, and realizing over time that politicians don't work for the people, they work for weapons companies and oil companies, and that we need to use other tactics and strategies to make change.
Right. I'm just curious, you were a 12-year-old lady when Donald Trump came into office for the very, very first time. So that's such a young age. How would such a young girl get interested even in the politics of these things? You know, what familial background helped you shape that sort of worldview?
Well, I grew up in the United States, but my family is Irish-American. Uh-huh. I've never been to Ireland. My family and my extended family, we aren't very connected to our Irish heritage or background. But once I started to learn about settler colonialism in the U.S. and how this entire American identity, just like the Israeli settler Zionist identity, is a genocidal construct that is built upon the blood of the indigenous peoples of North America, just like the Zionist entity is built upon the blood of the Palestinian people.
Right.
And so connecting to where I'm truly from, where my family is truly from, and learning the fierce, militant history of resistance in Ireland to colonialism, to imperialism, and solidarity with the Palestinian cause, I think gave me a much, much deeper understanding of what struggle means.
Of course.
That it's something that my people have been partaking in for 800 years against colonialism.
So this must have also been kind of a trigger for you to go and study the heritage and the background and what happened with the Irish cause.
That's
very interesting, of course. How did your early involvement in climate justice evolve into broader anti-imperialist work?
Like I said, I was part of a lot of climate organizing, of youth groups such as the Youth Climate Strike, and most of our actions were focused on asking politicians to change their policy. I participated in protests outside the White House, in the halls of Congress, begging our elected officials to listen to us to protect our future. And what I realized is that, asking politely the people in power to, make change that actually works against their own interests when these politicians' campaigns are funded by, all these corporations. And even many of the politicians who claim to be pro green energy, pro sustainability, such as Ed Markey, who I believe we're going to discuss in a bit. Many of them, talk this talk, but in reality, they support the U.S. military, which is the greatest polluter on planet Earth and has caused more environmental destruction and pollution than any other entity on planet Earth. And so, what I realized is that imperialism is the primary contradiction in the world today, and that is what we need to focus our struggle on, because it encompasses every single issue. We can't have climate justice, we can't have women's rights, we can't have fair housing and any of the things we want to see while we live in a system of global exploitation and, you know, constant war and genocide, which is what the U.S. and Zionist and NATO empire feed off of.
Right. Now I'm going to talk about a little bit about the digital organizing and the youth movements that you were part of. What was it like helping build the Markieverse and mobilizing Gen Z voters? Tell me about that.
First, let me just say it's crazy to hear that term said on Iranian TV, but that was a big effort.
I did my own work.
It was a big effort that I was involved in. I guess flash forward a couple years after I got involved politically, the COVID pandemic hit. I was 15. I was a sophomore in high school, and suddenly I was stuck at home and locked inside. And so all of the organizing that I was doing shifted to the digital sphere. And a lot of adults and folks, you know, working in political organizations and campaigns didn't know how to use the tools of social media to mobilize young people in the way that young people who are just fluent in these platforms do. And we innovated really creative techniques to turn out young voters, and we really emphasized, you know, the candidate that we were supporting, Ed Markey, his stance on the Green New Deal, on progressive legislation that we supported. But in retrospect, you know, a lot of that legislation, it was simply to improve the lives of people living in the U.S. And that is predicated upon the continuation of the, you know, exploitation of the global south, the continuation of these wars and these genocides. And I still learned a lot from those experiences. You know, I've arrived at the politics I have today by trying all these different tactics and strategies and realizing, you know, what is futile versus what actually poses a threat to the ruling class and to our oppressors.
Right. And how do you see digital activism changing the landscape of political engagement?
To borrow a phrase from Fidel Castro, I think the battle of ideas is being waged on social media. And so we cannot write off the digital sphere. We cannot write off these platforms as important battlegrounds for us to wage ideological struggle, to counter imperialist propaganda. If we look at how, you know, the CIA and various imperialist agencies' investments and strategies and budgets have shifted over the past decades, increasingly so much is being invested on propagandizing through the digital sphere. You know, I think some really good examples are the regime change attempts in Cuba and in Iran, which attempt to portray themselves as, you know, organic, homegrown protest movements, but in reality are usually hashtags that were created in Washington, D.C. or Langley, Virginia. And that's why I'm so honored to be here, because what I do have is a platform where I can, you know, share the reality that I'm seeing. And while I don't claim to be an expert on anything, really, I do think that, you know, having young people from the United States see this reality and see, you know, the destruction of that is caused by the U.S. Zionist aggression, and to bring back those lessons to people in the U.S. To understand is absolutely essential.
Well, you know, Carla, we are living in a world with mainstream media having the final say in many, many of the events that we are surrounded by. How do you make yourself heard by the people around you while they are also all being bombarded by these mainstream media regarding the truth that you have uncovered?
I think that's another, you know, change that's been caused by the shift to digital platforms and social media is, although mainstream media is dominant in many ways, social media kind of democratizes how we receive news. And so regular people, yes, despite, you know, not working for the BBC or CNN or MSNBC, we can create a platform for ourselves. And I think often that is so much more compelling to our audience and to people who want to understand what is happening in the world, because frankly, mainstream media is very dishonest. And I think the average person is smart enough to realize that and to be disillusioned with it. And the fact is they ignore, you know, the vast majority of what is actually happening in the world. And so to create our own platforms and to elevate our own voices and to speak the truth and without fear of being critical of power and of capital and of the imperialist ruling class is a great task, but I think it is one that we are seeing great progress on, and that consciousness is greatly shifting, especially among young people, and that is why the U.S. is trying to crack down on platforms like TikTok. That is why there is so much increasing censorship on platforms like Meta. I, of course, have been suspended many times on these platforms, but nevertheless, we have to continue to get our word out there, and we also need to be creative with how we disseminate ideas, because increasingly the censorship is only going to get worse, and we can't only be reliant on, you know, platforms that are controlled by our enemy.
Tell me something. I think within the American scene and the issue of censorship, I think it's getting harder and harder to get a message across. Do you think it's always been like that, or it has become visibly worse? Which one do you think it is?
I think it's both. You know, I think freedom of speech has always been a lie. It's freedom of speech for those who the government feels
almost
like it.
Almost everywhere.
Yes, but I do think we've seen some qualitative escalations and crackdowns in both the U.S. and in the so-called United Kingdom and in Europe. I would point to, you know, the prescription of Palestine Action in the U.K. as a really extreme example. And, you know, our comrades there, they can't even say the words Palestine Action without potentially being charged with terrorism. And in the United States, you know, it's not quite there yet, but we are seeing so many people being fired from their workplaces, being kicked out of their universities for mere anti-Zionist speech. You know, the sacrifice of losing a job or losing a degree is minuscule compared to what Palestinians are sacrificing, compared to what Iranians are sacrificing, compared to what, you know, the people in the entire global south, and especially the Axis of Resistance countries, are experiencing under U.S. Zionist imperialism. And so, in my view, the best way to respond to the censorship is to double down and to be louder than ever, because the louder that we are, the harder it is for them to silence us. And they actually can't possibly, you know, repress us all if we are all speaking out in support of the Palestinian resistance. And so while I expect for there to be more lawfare, for there to be more attempts to crush free speech, nevertheless, I think we have to, you know, double down on our pro-resistance speech. And, you know, I wanna shout out especially the organization Sami Dune, which was designated in Canada and the U.S., and there were restrictions placed on it because they support the Palestinian resistance and because they fight for the freedom of Palestinian prisoners. And there was a lot of fear that was instilled in people in the movement that if they even say, you know, I stand by Sami Nun because of this, during this, you know, phony designation, there's a lot of fear that that could, you know, even lead to people being targeted. But if we all stand together and if we all, you know, stand in solidarity with people facing repression, it is impossible for them to be isolated. So, yes, I think it's important to use these moments of the intensified repression to build more unity in our principles of resistance and steadfastness.
Right. And after working on, well, of course, you worked on Senator Markey's campaign. What led you to your disenchantment with electoral politics?
I'd certainly been, you know, slowly getting disenchanted over time. I think my values and my principles were always far more radical than what could be expressed in an electoral campaign. But those were the opportunities that I found to get involved in change. And I realized especially after taking part in protests in 2020, and then especially after what happened in Palestine in May 2021, the evictions in Sheikh Jarrah, the Six-Day War, and the bombardment of Gaza, that woke me up to the reality of imperialism and of the Zionist genocide against Palestine. And what I can only understand is my own complicity in that up until the moment that I broke with the U.S. states and working within the Democratic Party. Because the Democratic Party is, you know, just as genocidal and imperialist as the Republican Party. They just have different tactics and strategies through which they hold on to power. And like I said, I, you know, had worked for the senator, I'd worked for many politicians, and just seeing, you know, how horrific the bombardment was, and also how heroic the Palestinian response, the response of the resistance in Gaza was, firing back at the Zionist entity, I realized it was a moment where I had to make a choice that would define the trajectory for the rest of my life, which was to split with this liberal, reformist, social imperialist part of the, you know, movement that I was in, and to self-criticize, to use that as an opportunity to bring more people over to being pro-Palestine, to being anti-Zionist. We started a pressure campaign on the senator to try to get him to change his stance. And the failure of that to get him to change his stance also made me realize that even though that was someone I'd worked for and invested my labor in and helped him win the election, that my voice made no difference compared to checks from AIPAC or checks from Zionist donors or from weapons companies or his investment in U.S. interests. And so after that, I became much more involved in the pro-Palestine movement, and I basically completely left electoral politics, and from there on out spoke very vocally about how I feel like electoralism is ultimately, you know, counterinsurgent, and that we need to make a firm, clean break and to work outside of these institutions to, you know, create something new, to build an alternative to empire.
Right. And of course, you were involved with politics for a while. Did you find different voices? Like, for example, what we hear from Senator Bernie Sanders. Did you see that sort of voices often within the politics, within the mechanics and the machination of the mechanics of politics in the U.S.? Such voices, are they just rare, or there are still more than just one person in there thinking the way he does?
I think that I see, you know, I see Bernie Sanders, I see Ed Markey, I see AOC and the Squad. Even, you know, Zohran Mamdani, who just won this election in New York. I still see this progressive, or someone called like Democratic Socialist wing of the Democratic Party. I see it as a concerted effort to try to bring young people back into the Democratic Party because they have lost so much support because of Palestine. Because young people saw the Democratic Party carry out a Holocaust for 2 years, live streamed before our own eyes. No wonder people aren't coming out and weren't voting for Kamala Harris. And I think the Democrats realize that, and they realize they need younger, more progressive people who will say Free Palestine as a slogan to try to get people back into voting them and working in the party. But these people are not anti-Zionist. They're not anti-imperialist. They constantly defend Israel's right to exist. They constantly condemn the Palestinian resistance and the entire axis of resistance. They constantly promote, you know, regime change in sanctions against Iran. And so I think while it's positive to heighten the contradictions within within Congress, within the Democratic Party, within the U.S. government, electing these politicians is not a means to an end, and we have to be very, very careful with, you know, how working within these institutions might force us to compromise our principles. And so that's why I'm very openly critical of them.
Right, I see. And do you believe progressive candidates can still drive meaningful change within the system?
I think at the local level, that argument could be made. But I think, as I just argued, you know, I think fundamentally,
it kind of got my answer.
Yeah, it's I see it as, you know, a part of like the counterinsurgency, and I think when we have these huge ruptures and shifts of consciousness, like after the Al-Aqsa flood, there was a huge burst of, you know, anti-imperialist consciousness in the United States. And I think one of the responses by the Zionists, by the imperialists, by the ruling class is to try to capture that energy and to funnel it into something that is fundamentally not challenging or threatening to U.S. empire. And so they would much rather have us be working on a campaign than, say, doing direct action against a weapons company.
Carla Walsh, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Of course. And thank you for being with us on another soap. Thank you so much, and goodbye until next time.
Troubled story, tales full of sadness and woe. But I believe you smile again. You see, I know the pain you're feeling. I was there just like you before, and I know where it's leading. Hold on,
there's nothing standing in your way. You can be strong.
So show the world what you can do.
Like you're the outcast. Sometimes it's better to be alone than to be with the bad crowd. Preserve your mind and feed it. Nourish what it is you have inside. Use it in the right way.
To see you walk. This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, it's not a big deal. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, welcome to A to Z here on Iron Bridge Radio with me, Sister Zainab. And, you know, the idea of something not being a big deal, that's something that I think all of us sort of use at to some extent. You know, whether it's whether there's something going on in our lives that maybe we don't tell other people, or sometimes even if it's something big going on in our lives and we don't tell people what's going on, or maybe we've told people but we sort of shrug it off and laugh it off and we say, it's fine, it's not a big deal, it'll be okay. And, you know, why do we do that? Well, there might be several aspects. I'll start with one. One is, you know, in a sense, a very positive one. That is, we don't want to cause undue worry. And we also want to sort of give, sort of just nurture this idea that, yeah, you know, we're Muslim and, you know, we can cope with it. We can handle it. There might, so that's good. And maybe it's also a little bit of encouragement to other people to sort of understand, yeah, you know, it doesn't matter what's happening. We can, you know, we can just get on. It's even big things we can deal with. We'll get through them. You know, there'll be another day that maybe today is, you know, as our imams tell us, I think it was Imam Ali, that, you know, there'll be a day for us and there's a day against us, and we just deal with it. We just get on. The next day, the better day will come. So that's good, alhamdulillah. There might be another aspect, and that's something we need to be maybe a bit more aware of, and I think that's something I've read about recently too. Sometimes when we say something that, oh, it's not a big deal, it's not a problem, maybe... And this is really going into the inner work where we need to be careful. Maybe we're also trying to sort of prove to other people that, oh, we're really strong and we can cope with anything. And that maybe is a bit of a problem. So we need to be careful and maybe just sort of, let's say, take stock ourselves. Do we fall into that habit where we're almost trying to show off to others with how strong we are? So that's just something to be aware of. Welcome back to A to Z here on Iron Bridge Radio with me, Sister Zain. I'm talking about the different ways in which we sort of show that, you know, something's not a big deal, and different rationales or reasons we might have. And I've just pointed out one that we maybe need to be aware of. And I suspect that to some extent many of us fall into this one where we say, oh, it's not a big deal. And because maybe we want to sort of also say that, you know, I'm really strong. I can handle this. It's fine. I'll just brush it off. And, you know, there's another aspect to this. If something is really difficult and we're sort of suppressing, whether it's something physical pain or emotional pain, if we're suppressing something that we need to just be a bit more open about and just sort of say, yeah, look, this is tough. Can I just talk about this? That might actually be better in the long run, because I think psychology tells us, you know, it's just the way we are as human beings. If we suppress something, it can actually have bad consequences for our emotional state of being, and also physically. We can actually then develop physical issues. So just be aware of that too. Okay, but I also wanted to talk about just an anecdote from life of one of the martyrs from our defense, Sayyid Jan Bozorgi. So he did have this tendency to really not fuss over small things, and to basically always have this attitude of, you know, that nothing was a big deal, more or less. But, you know, with our martyrs, this really is this is definitely not this idea that, oh, I'm sort of, it's not a big deal, I'm trying to sort of show how strong I am. No, this really is, because they actually had reached that level of strength. There was nothing fake about it. So he was, even when he had been injured and was in hospital, he would basically try to get out of hospital as soon as possible. And we see this not just in his life, we see this in the lives of all the martyrs from the Holy Defense, basically. You know, there was basically nothing would keep them in hospital. So his hearing had even been impaired, but basically as soon as he regained consciousness, he was out. And, you know, so this is a particular level. Inshallah, we can all, if we can reach that sort of level of strength and resilience, wonderful. But, you know, in the meantime, we need to be a bit careful when we're sort of dealing with this attitude of, oh, it's not a big deal. So just be aware of these little lessons I've just sort of re-emphasized in what I've said today. So we don't fall into this thing of, you know, putting on a fake front. We don't want that either. So I pray you've gained some insights from today, and I look forward to welcoming you to another episode of A to Z here on I'm Youth Radio with me, Sister Zainab, and farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Thank you for joining us. Hebrew Media highlighted several issues, including confrontations that took place in the Syrian town of Beit Jinn between local residents and occupation forces. The issue of resistance fighters in the Rafah tunnels and the Israeli aggression against Lebanon. We will discuss these topics and more with Mr. Ridwan Razak, political analyst, joining us here in the studio. Hello and welcome, Mr. Ridwan.
Thank you.
The confrontations that erupted in the Syrian town of Beit Jinn and the Damascus countryside received significant attention in Hebrew media, which gave a detailed account of what took place. How would this incident affect the broader situation, including the talks that's being held between Netanyahu's administration and al-Julani regime?
That proves that Julani does not control Syria and does not control the groups in Syria. And that's very obvious what's happened in Beit Jinn. That's an organization, jihadist organization or group, decided to confront the Israeli, operating in those villages among the Haramun.
Which jihadi organizations, Mr. Ridwan?
Well, some reports connecting this group with the Muslim Brotherhood organization, mm-hmm. and proves that some of the people there or the villages are not very welcoming with the the Israeli army to freely operate in those villages, arresting or killing some of the let's say, people who wants to fight.
But these incidents can affect the talks that are being held between the two sides?
No, I don't think so, because Gulani brought to power to implement a certain agenda with the Israelis. And he announced very clearly that he will not allow any groups to operate against Israel or to threaten Israel in any way. So that means he will go along with the Israelis to prove that he can make a deal with the Israelis, that the Israelis will be freely operating along the borders with Syria, with his permission or without his permission. But for his own sake, he is going to...
Yeah, but al-Julani is supported by Turkey, and we all know Turkey's how Turkey views the Israelis. They do not like them at all.
Well, we can say that this is some kind of a struggle between Turkey and Israel, who is going to take over or to control Syria.
Yes.
So this proves that some of this understandable situation, because if the conflict of interest in Syria between Israel and Turkey, that might lead to some of what we have seen in Beijing. So we might also see that Gulani is very squeezed in the corner, because he is going to prove that to the Americans that he is controlling Syria and he can go for a deal. But at the same time, he cannot rule or stay in power without this direct support from Turkey.
Okay, but can we explain what happened as an anti-Israeli popular resistance that's being created in Syria?
Well, sooner or later, this resistance is going to be created and active, even among Druze or other outside Druze villages.
It's not developed yet with such an incident, you're saying?
It's on its way. I think it's under development, because things are not clear yet. But I think that formation of a resistance needs time and needs organizing. And especially in the area or in the region where the Israeli army is operating and or invading or taking off some of the Syrian villages or territories. So we might see in the future very similar or larger on a larger scale of resistance operation in Syria.
Okay, we're staying in Syria, where Israeli commentators called for taking more Syrian territory following the confrontations that took place in the town of Beijing. Would it be in Israeli strategic long-term interest to actually expand its occupation in Syria?
Of course. The plan of Netanyahu of creating greater Israel needs to take over Syria. This is what he comes across, the interest of Turkey in Syria, because also Syria wants to take, Turkey wants to take parts of Syria, especially Aleppo, and maybe control the whole country. And I believe that this operation, what's, happened in Beijing, I think if I want to figure it out in a very deep way, that this is a message from Turkey to the Israelis to prove to them that they have power or influence on some groups, which can shake the situation.
Yes, but Israel obviously is creating a dilemma for itself by trying to expand inside Syria. I mean, al-Julani is giving them the green light, whether for talks, whether for normalization. Why the fight?
Well, I think Gulani is in a very ambiguous situation, because he does not control anything. And
even the report here highlighted that obviously the Israelis are aware of the areas that al-Julani do not control, and they're saying that they should actually conquer it.
I don't believe at all on the situation, especially, last night I had a meeting and I have received lots of information on this, Syrian situation. I don't think that Gulani has any power outside his presidential palace, and he does not control anything at all, because so many groups, especially the foreigners among the...
And that's why the Israelis do not want to have serious talks or normalization, or even open the way for a talk with Gulani.
Because they don't believe that he does not have any credibility
and control
of anything. So that's why they are going along with their plan, with or without his permission.
So they view him as a weak?
Very weak. They consider him nothing but a Muppet in the hands of the Turks.
Even if they do that, why would they want to expand when they have the chance for a talk with the president, even if they view him as weak?
He is going to join the normalization of the treaties, and they will give full advance of the Israeli army operating anytime, anywhere in Syria without his permission or without without his permission. So
they're not in need of it, you're saying?
They don't consider him as a credible president or control his own country, so to make a deal with him.
Okay, now let's take a listen to some of the comments on Israeli social media about the confrontations that took place in Syria.
Roy Kais. In the Syrian town of Beit Jinn, the Islamic Group organization is based. It is a branch of the Muslim Brotherhood in Lebanon, maintains close ties with Hezbollah and Hamas. Jude. If the Israeli army withdraws from Syria, it would allow greater spread of organizations such as Islamic Jihad. Intel Times. There is activity against Israeli forces in southern Syria that closely resembles the activity of groups that operated against U.S. forces in Iraq.
Moving to Lebanon, Hebrew Media revealed U.S. efforts to change the formula of the ceasefire agreement in Lebanon in a way that serves the continuation of the Israeli occupation in southern Lebanon while maintaining freedom to carry out aggression there at any moment. Do you anticipate that the Americans are formulating a certain kind of agreement or a change in the ceasefire agreement with Lebanon?
Well, what's the need for the change? Because the ceasefire agreement was very clear that to stop all military operation and reach a total ceasefire. But the Israelis committed to their agreements on implementing the ceasefire in Lebanon. They did not. So by changing the deal, where they want to take the country? Because now we know that...
Maybe to give them a mandate to what they are doing. That's what the cause of the change in the formula.
Exactly. I believe that they are going to take a part of the south in Lebanon now to be under a full occupation of the Israeli army. So the Israeli army now freely operating with the mechanism watching and doing nothing at all, not even objecting or stopping the Israelis from reaching some of the towns. So they were putting the blame on the Lebanese army, which is, Lebanese army denied all accusations coming from Israel and proved, and he published a statement saying or showing the whole world what he did during the last year on operating south of Litani River.
But could such changes to the ceasefire agreement be understood as an alternative to a full-scale war? Can it be understood like that? Because here the commentator said that what is the need of going into a full-scale war when the Americans among the ceasefire included rights to Israel to move around? But in your perspective, could such changes to the ceasefire agreement be understood as an alternative to a large-scale war in Lebanon?
Well, during to my knowledge, was the conflict between the defense minister and the commander of the Israeli army. I don't believe that the Israeli army is capable now to launch a full-scale war.
Why?
Major war, because after almost 3 years in Gaza and Lebanon. Of fighting and operating, I think that the Israelis are not prepared to launch a major war. I think it's...
How would they function? Continue assassinations?
Continuation of, if we take this, some of the numbers that casualties and martyrs in Lebanon, reach about 1,500 people were killed or injured by Israeli operation without launching a major war during the last year. So this continuation of this policy might fulfill the interest of the Israelis on the ground without, endangering their
operation. So you
operation.
Don't view any change in the formula of the ceasefire agreement?
No, I don't think so.
We remain in Lebanon, where one Israeli commentator believed that after the assassination of martyr Tabtaba'i in Beirut's southern suburbs, the Israeli entity must strive to strike the leadership of Hezbollah in its entity. Do you think that Israel may embark on an intensified and assassination war with Lebanon?
Well, it's a continued since the October 27th, since last year, this policy did not stop, and it's continuing, and that proves that the assassination of Mr. Martyr Tabtaba'i, that the Israelis are going along with this policy. And we might see that some of the politicians even in Hezbollah, not only the military section, might be targeted by the Israelis. We might see some other targets like MP members of Hezbollah will be the next target of Israel.
Why? So what would that accomplish?
They think that they want to eliminate all the leaders of Hezbollah, military or politically. And they want to assassinate every person who might be the leader or the next leader to be appointed on Hezbollah. So this
to place more pressure on Hezbollah.
Well, they think they can eliminate the total elimination of Hezbollah even from the political life in Lebanon. So this comes to a situation where Hezbollah, at one point of a time, might be urged or needed to retaliate or launch a major attack against the Israeli army.
Okay, if they move forward with the analysis that you're sharing, what would be the ramifications of that?
Well, that might lead to a major war then, because now the war is not being ignited because Hezbollah is not responding or is not retaliating in any way at all. So to avoid any provocations of the Israeli army, and does not want to be dragged into a major war due to the consequences and the situation changed in Lebanon and Syria also, because that affected the situation. And with this green light, full green light from the Americans for the Israelis to do whatever they want to do on the ground or in the region. So Hezbollah might be able to delay the major war, but at one point of a time, if Hezbollah launch a major attack against the Israeli army in the south, that might lead the whole area to a major war.
Okay. And to the occupied West Bank, where Israeli aggression continues against camps and towns in the north. One Knesset member pointed out that relying on coordination with the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank is no longer effective, calling for cooperation with it to be halted. Mr. Ridwan, do you believe that the aggression in the West Bank will end the security coordination between the Palestinian Authority and the occupation?
Well, it's a very funny talks, because the agreement between the Palestinian Authority and the Israelis, did it prove that it can change the situation in the West Bank? The plan, or the Israeli plan in the West Bank, is they want to evacuate or to do to displace the Palestinians or to kick them out of the West Bank to Jordan or Lebanon, but they want to have the West Bank empty or total evacuation for the Palestinians.
Okay, this continuous aggression against the West Bank, would it actually end the security coordination?
It's leading to kick out the Palestinians out of the West Bank and to build more settlements, because we know that at the time that Oslo was signed, there were about 100,000 settlers in the West Bank. Now it's 800,000 settlers since the 1992. So this agreement did not change the situation and did not twist the Israeli plan from expanding its territories to be to control or to take over to a full occupation of the West Bank with no Palestinians in.
Where do you think that the occupation will go in its continued aggression in the West Bank?
Well, I think this is preparing,
as part of the annexation plan.
From my point of view, that will that might accelerate the ending or the destruction of Israel, for the country or the whole country will be falling down, because this expansion cannot be controlled by 6-7 million people. The territory is full of people, full of...
But they have the blessings of the American administration.
Well, the American administration does not change anything on the fact that people in the region now on the resistance move. So they cannot accept or will be able to accept the existence of Israel on other others' territories, and especially the whole Palestine. It's occupied by the Israelis. So the Americans, if they want to solve the situation, they must accept that this state cannot be continued. And what we are seeing in the America, by changing the American mind or the look at the whole situation, mm-hmm. is might be very bright, because the Americans are not, I'm talking about the American people here, about the public opinion, are not any longer buying the story of the Israelis.
Okay, Mr. Ridwan Rizk, thank you very much for joining this episode. You're a political analyst.
A warm greetings once again to all our dear listeners around the world. You're listening to Iran Radio. Iran Radio is here, and you are listening to some interesting facts about Islam. Muslims believe they are members of a worldwide Muslim community known as the Ummah, united by a religious bond that transcends tribal, ethnic, and national identities. The first mosque built in the U.S. was the Mother Mosque of America, which was built in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, in 1934. It is still used for worship today. Let's see what this next hour holds. Coming right up, it's news this hour. Then we have Minbar. After that, tune in for another special session of radio productions. And closing the hours, don't miss Leader's Speech. Thanks for joining us. Up next, news this hour.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
On the International Day of Solidarity with Palestine, the Iranian president calls for serious and effective measures by the world to stop Israel's aggression against Palestinians. The Israeli military continues to pound at various locations across Gaza with artillery and airstrikes, reaching a ceasefire with Hamas. And a new poll shows U.S. President Donald Trump's approval rating has hit its lowest point over his handling of rising prices and also the fallout from the Epstein files. Hello everyone, thank you for joining us here on World News. In our top story, Iran's president once again calls for serious and effective international steps to end Israeli aggression and violations against Palestinians. Masoud Pezeshkian made the comments in a letter to mark the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people. The president said the international community has to confront the Israeli regime for its open violations of international law. Pezeshkian added, ending organized occupation of Palestine and the right of return for Palestinian refugees are only sustainable solutions to the Palestinian issue. He further called Israel the most serious